Today is Monday, December 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, why Americans are paying such close attention to a Senate race in the state of Alabama.
We're dealing with this moment where people all across the country are talking about accusations of sexual misconduct, sexual assault of various kinds, harassment.
The Palestinian leader says he won't sit down to meet with the vice president. California's out-of-control wildfires are growing. Also ahead, why a pop singer's accomplishment has become so controversial. It's all on today's International Edition. Voters in the U.S. state of Alabama are about to pick a new senator in a predominantly Republican state that's being closely watched across the country. Roy Moore, who was accused of sexual misconduct by two women, one of whom was 14 during the time he was a local prosecutor, is locked in a tight contest with Democrat Doug Jones, a former federal prosecutor. The winner will fill the remaining 3 years of the Senate seat once held by Jeff Sessions, who resigned to join President Trump's cabinet as Attorney General. Alabama senior senator Republican Richard Shelby said Sunday the state deserves better than the election of Moore, accused of those sexual improprieties. President Trump, though, has in recent days mounted an aggressive campaign for Moore, including recorded robocalls to voters in Alabama.
And we want jobs, jobs, jobs. So get out and vote for Roy Moore. Do it.
Well, joining us now to discuss is national political reporter for Politico, Gabriel DiBenedetti. So first, explain to our listeners why this Alabama contest is being so closely watched.
Well, there are a few reasons here. One is that we're dealing with this moment where people all across the country are talking about accusations of sexual misconduct, sexual assault of various kinds, harassment. And what Roy Moore has been accused of is obviously an extreme version of that, specifically going after minors. But when we look at the politics of it, this is also a big moment because it's a time when Democrats think that they can finally start fighting back after some big victories last month. And Alabama is an extremely conservative state. So for Democrats to even be competitive here, it's a pretty big moment for them. So there's a whole confluence of issues that's really making people pay closer attention than they normally would.
And what would it say for President Trump, who actually just pretty much came out and endorsed him? First, he was keeping very silent about it, and now he's fully on board. But what will it say about the president, depending on the outcome?
Well, that's a great question, and we don't really know yet. But as with all things in politics right now, it's all about President Trump. Roy Moore is trying to make the final piece of this race a referendum on how Alabamians feel about Donald Trump. His campaign is really trying to win over some people who are big Trump fans but are skeptical of him. So if Moore is able to do it, it might show that Trump really does have this ability to really rile up Republicans or conservatives that might not be otherwise interested in voting. On the other hand, it could also show us if Doug Jones, the Democrat, wins, if he is to win, it would likely be because of higher than usual African-American turnout, which sort of makes up his base. And if that's the case, that's likely going to be because of black revulsion with President Trump, especially after he did come out and endorse Moore earlier this week.
What about the Republicans, the very few Republicans, like Senator Richard Shelby, that said, you know, they just can't vote for him? Will that have any impact on voters there? Do they have any influence? Or would you say the president is a bigger influence? Or is that something that remains to be seen at this point?
The president is no doubt the biggest influence overall, but there are a lot of Republicans, just like Shelby, the other senator, who have said that they can't vote for Roy Moore. It's easy to forget, but Roy Moore is an extremely controversial figure even before all these accusations, and a lot of Alabama Republicans have hated him for decades. So in order for Jones, the Democrat, to win, he's going to have to win over a lot of conservative or Republicans who really feel like Moore doesn't represent them. So what they're betting on is that Shelby saying that he didn't vote for him, other prominent Republicans casting doubt on him, someone like Jeff Sessions, for example, that really matters more than President Trump. But it remains to be seen. We'll find out the answer to that question on Tuesday.
And if for some reason there is a pretty big upset, which would mean a Democrat would actually win that seat in Alabama, sure. If that were to happen, would you say that that would send a pretty clear message to Republicans that they may be in trouble come 2018 for midterms, which could certainly do damage to the president's agenda?
Let's be clear. The result on Tuesday is going to be a political earthquake no matter which way it goes. If Roy Moore wins, Republicans are going to have to deal with what it means to have someone like him representing them in the Senate. But if he loses and Democrats actually do have a senator in Alabama for the first time in two decades, it definitely does raise serious questions for the National Republican Party about what's going to happen in 2018. A lot of them are saying, well, if Roy Moore loses, it's because he's an extremely flawed candidate, not because the party overall is in trouble. But the reality is that he didn't get to this point just because he's an unpopular candidate. There is no doubt that the country is certainly going through an interesting moment politically, but after big wins in the off-year elections in 2017 or earlier last month, Democrats are certainly feeling pretty confident, and they do think that if they are able to beat Roy Moore, it shows that there are signs that something even larger than they anticipated could be happening for 2018.
That's national political reporter for Politico, Gabriel DiBenedetti. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. After avoiding an early marriage, Malawi woman is providing free education to rural girls. The Nobel Peace Prize winners are urging nuclear powers to sign a UN treaty. Iraq is celebrating victory over Islamic State with a parade. And Spain rescues 104 migrants crossing the Mediterranean. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. A new wave of protests against President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the Israeli capital erupted on Sunday in parts of the Muslim and Arab world. French President Emmanuel Macron, meeting with other European leaders, condemned the attacks on Israel, but said he opposes Trump's decision on Jerusalem.
France wishes two states in peace and with borders recognized internationally to be established, Israel and Palestine. And against this background, I explained to Prime Minister Netanyahu my disapproval of the recent declarations by the President of the United States, which France considers in breach of international law and dangerous for peace. Dangerous for peace because I believe these statements do not serve security, including the security of Israel and the Israelis.
Well, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he respectfully disagrees with Macron.
On the quest for peace, there is a serious effort underway now by the United States. And all I can say, as I said, related to President Macron, I think, if you'll pardon the expression, we should give peace a chance. By bringing things to their historical truth, by opening up the possibility of renewed negotiations with a renewed initiative.
Well, earlier Sunday, the Arab League called Trump's decision a dangerous development in a statement issued early Sunday after an emergency meeting of League foreign ministers in Cairo. It said it was a dangerous development and a decision that also strips the U.S. of its role as a sponsor or broker in the Mideast peace process. Also this weekend, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said he won't meet with Vice President Mike Pence during Pence's visit to the region this month. Pence's office called it unfortunate that Abbas didn't want to engage in dialogue. Joining me now to discuss all of it is Mark Katz, professor of government and politics at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. First of all, your reaction to Abbas's decision not to meet with Pence, and could that hurt the process further, as they claim?
If the Trump administration hadn't recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, then I don't think Mahmoud Abbas would have made this move, and so we would have had a meeting between Vice President Pence and him. So it's not clear to me that they really were thinking this through about what impact on the peace process, which they are, you know, attempting to secure, that this move would have. And I think basically the recognition that this was more for American domestic politics than anything else. And I don't think that whoever made this decision wasn't, I think, really thinking about the peace process.
Well, the president said that they have an actual plan in place that they will be revealing soon. And Ambassador Nikki Haley also said that it may not appear that way, but this actually pushes us closer to peace.
In making a move that the Palestinians are very unhappy about, it's not clear to me how this will motivate them to agree to a peace, but who knows, maybe I'm wrong. There have been so many American administrations who have attempted to achieve an agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians. None of them has worked. Something would have to be really different about this proposal, which we don't know what it is yet, to make things work. And I personally doubt that that's going to be the case.
If the ultimate goal is a two-state solution where both can live side by side in peace, would saying that Jerusalem is Israel's capital and possibly moving the U.S. moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, how would that work with a two-state solution? Could it?
Well, certainly, Russia's Vladimir Putin last April, what he did was he recognized West Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and East Jerusalem as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Now, I've seen some accounts that indicate that that is essentially what the Trump administration is trying to do here as well, but they're trying to make it appear far more pro-Israeli to please the Trump base. But if this is what he's done, is obviously he's convinced too many in the Arab world that in fact he means to recognize Jerusalem in its entirety as Israel's capital. And obviously we've seen a lot of negative fallout as a result.
We have seen violence, and do you expect this to get worse before it gets better?
It's possible that it could. It's also possible that it will blow over. But I think that now, in other words, for that to happen, that some positive diplomatic progress is going to have to be made soon. But it's just the kind of thing where it could simmer on. On the other hand, news moves on all the time. So if there really is something in the works, they'd better get on with it, it seems, to distract from this. But I'm not sure that's the case. I'm not quite sure how much violence is going to result. What I'm pretty clear is that this announcement in and of itself is not going to lead to peace. Not going to lead to an end of violence.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Mark Katz, professor of government and politics at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. New evacuations were ordered in Santa Barbara County in Southern California Sunday as the largest wildfire currently burning in the state threatened a number of coastal towns. Nearly a half dozen fires burned across Southern California over the past week, burning more than 670 square kilometers since Monday. New fires keep erupting in dry conditions and are being stoked by relentless westward Santa Ana winds, which have been gusting up to 80 kilometers per hour. A new report from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory predicts a link between sea ice melting in the Arctic and drier conditions in California over the next several decades. This finding comes at a time when several wildfires continue to rage. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports on the work of different scientists as they look at the global implications of glaciers and sea ice melting and other impacts a changing climate could have around the world.
From devastating wildfires in California to the frozen Arctic, scientists say there may be a link.
Ice is disappearing from the Arctic Ocean, it's disappearing from Greenland, and this is reshaping climate patterns all across the planet.
There's large-scale warming of the Arctic and the increasing loss of sea ice. A new simulation that only looks at sea ice in the next two decades shows a pressure ridge pushing the winter air masses north into Alaska and Canada, which impacts California, says atmospheric scientist Ivana Sianovic in a Skype interview.
And we saw quite substantial drying of California. So due to sea ice alone, we saw 10 to 15% decrease in precipitation over a 20-year period.
You can see the red colors here show where Greenland has lost mass.
Looking at ice, and more specifically glaciers, has been Josh Willis's job lately. On a recent mission to Greenland to see how much oceans are eating away at the ice, What he found has global implications.
Warm water is widespread across the Greenland shelf, and it is very much a major threat to the glaciers. The thing we really don't know is how fast is Greenland's ice going to disappear. If it takes 1,000 years or 2,000 years, then we can probably adapt. But if it happens in a few hundred, we should already be evacuating cities around the world.
What Willis and other scientists can't predict is the climate in regions of the world such as the American Southwest.
We will probably see drier conditions in the long run in the second half of the 20th century in the Southwest. And that means we're going to struggle with water needs and also fire and all the issues that that carries with it.
Dry conditions plus a growing population equals more wildfires and costly devastation.
We are in Southern California, and a lot of the fires we find that happen right where people intersect with the wildland happen because of people.
Fire expert Natasha Stavros expects environmental changes as the weather evolves.
As we experience climate changes and things become hotter and drier, fire acts as kind of like an eraser, right? It erases the landscape, and it actually allows new ecosystems to establish because they don't have to compete with what was there.
The American Southwest is not the only place where change is predicted.
As the atmosphere heats up, it becomes a better pipe for carrying water, for picking it up in one place and dumping it in another. This means that dry places are likely to get drier and wet places are likely to get wetter. It also means that bigger, more torrential downpours become more likely.
Willis predicts in the future, the world will have more severe floods and droughts, but where they will be happening may change over time. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, winners of the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize are sounding an alarm as they urge nuclear nations to adopt a UN treaty banning atomic weapons. Beatrice Finn, who accepted the award on behalf of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, in a speech following the group's acceptance of the award, asked an ominous question.
The story of nuclear weapons will have an ending. And it is up to us to decide what that ending will be. Will it be the end of nuclear weapons? Or will it be the end of us? One of these things will happen. The only rational course of action is to cease living under the conditions where our mutual destruction is only one impulsive tantrum away.
Finn warned in particular about warlike threats exchanged between North Korea and the United States amid nuclear tests by Pyongyang. The Geneva-based group, which received the Nobel Peace Prize earlier this year, consists of about 500 organizations in more than 100 countries that are working toward global nuclear disarmament.
We represent those who refuse to accept nuclear weapons as a fixture in our world. Those who refuse to have their fates bound up in a few lines of launch code. Ours is the only reality that is possible. The alternative is unthinkable.
In a break from tradition, the three Western nuclear powers, the U.S., France, and Britain, sent second-ranking diplomats rather than their ambassadors to Sunday's ceremony. Receiving the award with Finn was 85-year-old Setsuko Thurlo, a survivor of the Hiroshima atomic bombing and now an ICANN campaigner who described horrible scenes in the aftermath of the atomic bomb in 1945 when she was 13 years old. Nearly three decades after the end of the Cold War, the debate between disarmament versus deterrence is still being fought. Pop artist Bebe Rexha just made history as the first female artist to debut in the number one spot on the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart with the song Meant to Be, featuring Florida Georgia Line. This accomplishment has sparked much controversy, though, leaving many fans of country music disillusioned and disappointed. Nikki Strong of VOA1 joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to explain why it's such a controversial accomplishment.
Bebe Rexha. I mean, when I first saw her on the top of the chart, I was like, huh? She has no well-known, I'll say, well-known connection to the country music community. It's not like she's Kelly Clarkson or even like a Taylor Swift. Her connection is Florida Georgia Line, which are the guys, you know, initially
Oh, right.
Who sing on the track, right? So that's first and foremost, is like, who is she to those in the country community? And then Florida Georgia Line, a lot of people have a love-hate relationship with these guys anyway, because, you know, some argue that they really are like wannabe pop artists. In large part because their music can, you know, has crossed over. And in the whole what is real country music debate, they're like the poster child for not being real country music, the epitome of bro country. You know, and others say they just simply expand the boundaries of the genre. You know, like they reflect what's happening now. You know, either way, I don't hate Florida Georgia Line. It's clear that to me that they are a country pop group. Their leanings are pop, and they have had their fair share of number one hits on the chart, and they're very accomplished. And so whether people like them or not, they are considered country artists, and they have a huge fan base. And a lot of their music, yes, is very catchy. But Bebe is interesting because she is the first woman to debut in the number one spot on the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart, and this is a slap in the face, really, to women like Reba and Dolly and Miranda Lambert and Kacey Musgraves that have been holding down the fort, and still, no matter how good they are, you know, they have still have not really gotten their fair share of recognition for their work on air or on the charts. And that informs awards and all that other stuff. Carrie Underwood hasn't even debuted in the number one spot on this chart.
Wow.
Yes. And another thing is that the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart, these Billboard charts in general yield a lot of influence. So they help determine playlists across the country. I mean, I'm always looking at the Billboard charts. And so it can really help make an artist be a huge commercial success. So for a pop artist to debut in the number one spot impacts how much more difficult, you know, it is for an artist who loves and works in the genre to get, well, easy to get sideswiped by an artist who doesn't work in the genre.
So how did this happen?
Okay, how did it happen? All right, so there is an article that I recommend that really, it really breaks down it in more detail. It's on a website called savingcountrymusic.com. I posted it on my Facebook page, IAMNIKKISTRONG. I am Nikki Strong, so you can take a look at it there. But for the sake of time, here are a couple of the key elements that contributed to this happening. Part of it is Billboard changed how it determines its spots on the charts. So they use what is now called a hybrid data list, which blends airplay, streaming, and sales. So on the airplay side, of course, there was a push to both country and pop radio formats for this song. But this chart now allows for spins on pop radio to count on the country charts.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. And Bebe is a pop artist, you know, and she gets love on pop radio stations. It counts on country. So, and another key is sales. Now, most downloads are priced at like $1.29, you know, on iTunes and Amazon. This one was priced at 69 cents.
Oh.
So, which of course drives up sales. This is not a new trick. This is very common. I remember when an R&B artist, Ashanti, when she debuted her CD and it was priced at $9.99 when the average CD cost at that time was like $16.99.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. It's something, you know, that is part of, it's a promotional price. That's what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And so now this is interesting because one paid download, so that already encourages downloads, and one paid download is considered 150 streams of a song.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, if you do the math, it really, it increases your number of streams. Now, streaming itself, so this is a whole other element. So you have the sales, you have airplay, you have streaming. Streaming itself is counted from a variety of sources. So Spotify, YouTube, and other platforms. And paying some of these platforms to promote your music is not uncommon either. You know, it's even possible to buy a spot on particular digital playlist. And so, which all of these playlists also help to convince radio programmers to play a particular song, which then increases their airplay, increases their downloads, increases the overall exposure of the song, which helps drives it to the top of the chart. So that's how, in a nutshell, how that happened.
Well, how is the song itself?
I think the song is very catchy. It's hooky. It's very radio friendly. It's a feel good pop song. We'll see over the course of time how this will play out on country radio stations across the country.
Oh, should be interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, you can share your thoughts with Nikki on this topic on Facebook and Twitter at VOA1 The Hits. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
If it's meant to be, it'll be, it'll be. Baby, just let it be. If it's meant to be, it'll be, it'll be. Baby, just let it be. So won't you ride with me, ride with me. See where this thing goes. If it's meant to be.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Governments that sponsor or condone violence or discrimination against their own people are more likely to see extremism grow in their country. If left unchecked, human rights violations and abuses and poor governance spawn radicalized individuals and communities that can escalate into threats to international peace and security, said Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs Steve Goldstein. It's very clear in countries where human rights abuses occur, there's a greater growth of terrorism, said Undersecretary Goldstein. Preventing violent extremism is core to the work of the Trump administration. The tools of democracy are a critical component to how we confront terrorism. President Donald Trump's administration is exploring opportunities to build tolerance and accountability, to counter violent extremism, and bring new voices to conversations about inclusive governance. We work daily to try to address human rights issues around the world, said Undersecretary Goldstein. The Secretary and other members of the administration bring issues of human rights up with foreign leaders when they travel. We try to make the point that ensuring democracy is vital and that we have a responsibility to our citizens and that these world leaders have responsibility to their citizens to provide an environment where human rights can grow and prosper. The United States will continue to advance human rights through bilateral and multilateral engagement, public diplomacy, and supporting human rights defenders and civil society organizations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.